Welcome to the Distance to Empty podcast, the podcast where we blab on and on about 200 plus mile ultramarathons, multi-day efforts, what it takes to train for them, what it takes to complete them, race them, what it takes to obsess about them, think about them all day. Anything else, Peter?
Dream about them? Did you say dream?
I didn't say dream. What it takes to dream about them. Good call. I'm your host, Kevin Goldberg, and I'm here with my co-host, Peter Noyes. We're going to jump right into it today. We have an exciting episode. It's been really cool to talk to race directors. It's certainly opened up my perspective, and today is no different. Brian Gallant, the race director of the Divide 200. Brian, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Great. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Yeah, we're stoked to chat. Can you kick us off by just giving us sort of an overview of what Sinister Sports is, how it came to be, and sort of how you got to the place where you're now putting on a crazy 200-mile race?
Yeah, sure. So we started Sinister Sports from, it kind of came out of another small company that eight of us started together back in 2002 and late 2001. And there were eight of us originally, and we were all adventure racers. And we thought there would be something we could do to kind of make adventure racing big in Alberta and BC. And, you know, it started with that group. Very quickly, people started to follow off once they realized how much work it was. And so over the years, you know, had different people involved, but now I'm the only director. And I have a great crew of people that help make it all happen. And I couldn't do it without them. The Divide itself, it's a little more complicated than that because due to like legislative issues and permitting and such, we realized right away that we couldn't do it on our own. So we actually partnered with a nonprofit called the Western Ultra Racing Association. And they they own the Divide 200. And I work as their race director. And I bring the resources of Sinister Sports to them at their disposal to make it happen. So it's been a really great sort of symbiotic relationship. The idea for the Divide was mine, definitely, but they were instrumental in making it happen.
So how many races does Sinister Sports put on altogether?
This year we have five, and you know, we have different distances, everything ranging from our shortest is a 28K. All the way up to the Divide 200, which is obviously a 200 miler. You know, we really want to make sure that we are looking at entry points for people. Actually, I should say, I'm sorry, we have six races this year. I completely glitched on that. So we have our three sort of traditional ultras, then we have the Divide 200, then we have our Castle Alpine Trail race, which is a shorter race at 28K. And then now we have a loop race in November called the Dark 24. And it's a loop race, but it's in an underground coal mine. So they get to run up and down the same stretch of corridor over and over for up to 24 hours.
That's wild. So the whole race is inside a coal mine?
Yeah, you're allowed to go out and the food's outside. You know, we kept everything out in the open, which, you know, was a bit of a strategy on their part because the mine is quite warm. It's just above freezing most of the time. And the more you open the door, the cooler it gets. And the more you step outside, the cooler you get. So trying to, you know, minimize their time outside was actually really important.
Huh. Is it dark the whole time? Do they need headlamps the entire time?
You know what? They didn't need headlamps. We put a few lights down there. And we actually asked people not to wear headlamps because we didn't want to blind anybody.
Sure.
And, you know, because you're running into somebody's headlamp over and over again is going to be a bit much. We suggested using them as waist lights instead. And ultimately, I think everybody took them off in the end, or most people did. It doesn't take much for your eyes to adjust. And then the LED lighting that we did install along the route, it was more than enough to keep it, you know, bright. There were spots where it was a little dim and you could, you know, trip yourself up a little bit. But other than that, it was really, really easy to see.
That's fascinating. What's the duration of that race?
Up to 24 hours.
Oh, very cool.
Well, cool. So what motivated you to organize Canada's, you know, first and only 200 mile race?
Reckless naivety, I guess. I don't know. I have so many ideas for events, and it's a matter of you know, what are we going to be able to do that works in our season. And if you know the sort of the current day speaker and thinker, Simon Sinek, he has a really interesting book and TED Talk called Start With Why. And I've always been a really big believer in that. Ever since I heard it, really resonated with me. So I am always looking to do things that challenge people. I'm always looking to work with people that really want to shine and bring their best. That kind of drives everything we do. And it's this sort of sense of wonder still in what people can accomplish. And I was looking at our season and I thought, you know, we have a great crew of people. And I never really had felt at any time in our organization's history that we were so prepared to take on something big. And so what we would have been in the fall, early fall of 2022, I was just talking to the crew and I said, you know, I have had a draft budget and a draft plan for a 200 mile race sitting in my archive for years now. And I kept looking at it thinking, wow, this is just so big. I can't possibly see us pulling it off. And with the crew that we have now, I felt, like I said, for the first time that we were really in a position where we could make it happen. And it was fun to think that we were going to be the first big mountain 200. There was one other 200 miler in Ontario a few years back. They were a very different format. You kind of just loop the same course over and over again. So I'd say as far as a course that's not looped and it's in the mountains and it's, you know, not just sort of repeating the same course over and over, this is the first one of that kind and definitely the first in the West. And, you know, there's a bit of pride to that as well. You know, we really wanted to bring something big to the area. I really feel a connection to the land around me here. The Southern Alberta foothills and the Southern Alberta Rockies, where I live, just to the east of me are the foothills, and just to the west of me is the Continental Divide. I mean, I have two different mountains outside my window with a cliff behind me, with a waterfall right behind me. It's a really inspiring spot. And that terrain really speaks to my soul. That sounds a little bit hokey maybe, but when I first, I grew up in Southern Alberta, but a little farther north than here. When I first visited this specific area, I thought, you know, this is where I'm meant to be. And I felt that resonate with me. So that wanting to share that really was a big driver behind it. More specifically, some of the details, when the pandemic was happening and everything was shut down, I'm good friends with the director, the executive director of the Great Divide Trail Association. And we just started chatting, you know, we had lots of time on our hands. So we started chatting about things that we could do to include some more visibility around the Great Divide Trail. And I just got to think, you know, there's got to be a way to really celebrate that in a competitive fashion like we do. And that was sort of the basis of what made the Divide 200. The love of the land and the love of the people and just wanting to see people bring their best.
So what is, you know, you've had this idea in your book for a while, you know, you've ruminated on it, you've, you know, it's been a dream, but, you know, as someone who's volunteered at these races and run many of them, like the idea of putting pen to, you know, or the difference from putting pen to paper to putting it in action just seems so insurmountable. What is, you know, it's 2022 and you say, all right, we're going to roll the dice on this and try to create this thing. What's step one? Like, how do you bring something like this to life as the race director? I know you mentioned getting kind of outside help, but, you know, like, how do you take it from ideation to creation? And, you know, then in September of 2023, it's actually out, you know, in the world, it's live, it's running, people are completing it. Like, take us through that journey.
Yeah, no, it's not a linear process. And I'm not really a linear thinker. So I tend to have, you know, 16 different browser windows going in my head at all times. So I'm trying to pulling together stuff from these different sort of mental folders I have. You know, it can be partly inspiration from a place, like I mentioned. You know, I really am in love with the Continental Divide region in the Southern Rockies, and you know, the first thing for me was actually talking to my crew and making sure that everybody was on board. And, you know, they're a very passionate group of people. And I think that I didn't really have any doubt. But, you know, it's not just me. I mean, unless the race crew, the people that work closely with me, are really into it, then it's kind of hard to pull it off. You know, everyone has to bring that passion. If they're not feeling passionate about it, then it's not going to happen. And I really believe that. You know, there's lots of races out there. And there are a lot of races out there, and it's the ones that really make it are the ones where they have a lot of passion for what they're doing. And so we need to keep bringing that. And so we talked about a lot of different ideas about how it could run. But, you know, I started to look at using large stretches of the Continental Divide Trail, the Great Divide Trail. That was sort of my starting point, my jumping off point. Simultaneously, you know, I was trying to figure out permitting, not from the detail standpoint of, you know, like writing up a document to submit, but trying to understand who I would have to talk to and the process we'd have to go through, because that can become insurmountable in and of itself if it becomes too onerous. You know, in some cases, permits are taking, in some jurisdictions, you know, over 400 days to get. And that just makes it impossible for a small organization to do something quickly. And then, you know, I really like to focus on areas where I've explored. I mean, I've been running up and down these trails for 20 years now, and just picking up places that I thought were really important and including them and trying to string those together in a meaningful way, not just adding kind of junk miles in between. I didn't want to make it so it was just a bunch of features that were tied together by a bunch of mediocre grunt work. So finding a route that was really, that's when I started to work on the route of, you know, something that's going to be really, really inspiring. You know, I wanted to make sure there was also a good balance of hard and then chances to recover yourself. The race starts off really, really hard for the first 60K. And it's pretty relentless. And then after that, you get some more chances to kind of find your pace. And it's not easy throughout by any means, but you get a chance to really relax. So making sure we had a balance there. There was some stuff that I wanted to include originally that would have easily made the first sort of two stages double the duration. I mean, I originally wanted them to run along what's called Barnaby Ridge, which is a chain of mountains that's really, really difficult. It's spectacular up there, but, you know, finally in the end, I realized, you know, one accident up there, and it's an area where people will be prone to have a fall. And, you know, the whole race is pretty much thrown into turmoil at that point. So I just realized there's a limit to what we can do here, but, you know, I worked with some local guides that I know that I'm friends with, local explorers and hunters. They bring a great deal of knowledge. And like I said, I've been hiking these areas for 20 plus years now. So I have a pretty good familiarity with a lot of these trails already. The trails have changed in the last while. So getting up to speed on what's allowed and what's not, because we are working in different jurisdictions. There's a provincial park here now, which didn't exist even, I think, less than 10 years ago. So that was something we had to kind of contend with. And so understanding how all those parts are going to work together. And then just making sure that the fine tweaking of getting the distance right, you know, not being too long or too short. I'm okay with not being exactly 200 or exactly 100 or whatever. I think that's normal to be a little bit off on those things, where it's not a road marathon. You can't just stop them at a pylon on the highway and turn them around, right? So I'm okay with that, but I wanted it to be really true to the 200-mile distance as much as possible. And so that meant little tweaks here and there, looking at things like, if you send them out on a kind of a loop, are they going to be able to cut that off somewhere? Are there trails where they could accidentally cheat, you know, like cutting off a distance unintentionally? There's a lot of like our death race course, there are several spots where people would cut through and follow the signs because they overlap each other. And that's the kind of thing I like to avoid. So working really hard to find those things. Been building relationships. Choosing the host site was a big part of it. Negotiating how that was going to look. You know, it's a big undertaking for us, but it's also a big undertaking for them. And choosing, I think one of the most important parts of hosting an event is to choose the sort of the style you want. And in our case, I really wanted to celebrate the racers. So when we welcome them, we have a big banquet. And at the close of the race, we have another big banquet. We're not just talking like a little taco buffet or anything here. I mean like a nice big dinner. You know, we didn't just go with like the cheap custom buffet. We went with like the wedding package for the that the resort, Castle Mountain Resort, has for their wedding planners. And we really wanted to make it special. You know, to me, this is an incredible celebration. Given the fact that we're in some really environmentally sensitive areas, we were also very cognizant that we had to keep the numbers low. And we wanted to make sure that that people who are getting into it understand that, you know, we're very sensitive to the fact that races are, you know, even though it's on foot and even though it's generally considered low impact, it's not no impact. And beyond just the considerations of things like ground disturbance, you have to think about wildlife migration, you have to think about the local plant growth, and you have to think about the mating cycles of the different animals in the area. So those are the kind of things that we also focused on. And it kind of all just springs from that. So there's lots of parts to it. And it's not just one thing or another. It all kind of has to happen simultaneously in some ways. And a lot of it you learn as you go. Even now, you know, I've been hosting events for, this is my 23rd year. And I'm still learning new things and best practices and evolving best practices and learning from local stakeholders about what they expect. And they're changing needs about managing the landscape. So it's never a dull moment.
So you talked about the race needing to remain small because it's an ecologically sensitive area. So can you talk a little bit about how you keep that race small? What's the process to get in? How you select who gets into the race?
Sure. Well, we started last year with a lottery, and we wanted to, first thing we do is we just impressed upon people in the language leading up to it, that you really need to have good experience in the Alpine. We don't care if they're specifically an ultra marathoner, somebody who is a through hiker. Through hiking is extremely popular in this area. I mean, we live right on the Continental Divide route. So I see them on the highway all the time. Like when the Great Divide Trail pops out onto the highway not far from where I live, and I'll pass by them all the time, and I'll actually give them rides to the trailhead if I'm going the same way, because it's they have to walk a few K on the highway. We really wanted to, first of all, impress upon people that they need to have Alpine experience, and that I think making people understand that was a big part of limiting. And I hate to say it that way, but it limits the number of people that will sign up for the race. We do have a vetting process, and there have been a few people we said, look, you know, based on the experience that we've seen and what you put into your profile, do you really think understand what it takes to do this? And that's not meant to be demeaning. Everybody starts somewhere, and maybe this isn't the best race to start with. But again, you know, people that had great through hiking experience were just as equally qualified as somebody who has lots of ultra marathon experience. But we did talk to a few people and said, look, you know, it's probably not the race for you, and that's okay. Just set that as a goal for the future and get some more training in on your own, and come out with us and do things, you know, and get involved and volunteer and help out and get this kind of experience. And then we did have the lottery, and we put the lottery in place. And the first year we had, I think, around 350 applicants. I can't even recall now. It was at least 350 applicants. And so that worked out pretty well. This year, we actually ended up dropping the lottery, because what happened was we opened it in like earlier in the fall, and then we had several hundred people sign up. We picked our first 110 actually, thinking probably 10 of them would say no, but we actually had about half of them say, yeah, I've changed my mind. By the time we went a month later to do a second draw, a lot of the people that weren't drawing the first time said, okay, well, I've already made other plans, so I can't come now. So the race is full, but it took a lot more work. So we just decided, you know what, the lottery was meant to make it so that people who didn't have the money up front didn't have to struggle to get in or not get in because just because it was a financial thing. But we're still willing to, you know, work with people to do like a payment plan if they need it. So if they really want in and they're not ready to pay the full fee all at once, then because it's an expensive race to put on, and that's reflected in the registration fee. And so we'll work with them to get in. So it's not like it's going to cut anybody out in that regard. But yeah, it's definitely going to be now just once the race is full, it's capped and we'll have a waiting list. Unfortunately, I'm sure everyone can understand that once you get closer to the race date, trying to replace somebody who's just not everybody's just going to be able to pick up and run a 200 miler a couple months out, right? They need to really focus and train for that and mentally prepare themselves for that. And financially, because it's not just about the race fee, it's about the travel and accommodations and support crew and pacers and all that kind of stuff that they want to bring as well. Because a lot of people bring their families too, right? So it becomes a big family ordeal, not ordeal, but a family adventure together. And, you know, they have to think about the kids in school and that kind of stuff, right? So it's not just one thing. So, you know, we're really content with the number where it is right now. We're just over 100 people. Eventually, I think we want to try and raise it to 150. I think that we were planning to do that for this year, but I think that just the way things are working out with the registrations and with the permitting process, that we're just going to skip that for this year and look towards that for next year. I think we have a good case to show the especially the parks people that 150 or even 200 would be manageable. It is a big consideration because one of the first parts of the race is an alpine ridge line that is absolutely stunning, and at the same time it's also full of mountain goats and bighorn sheep, and this is an important time for them. And you know, it's the fall is they're migrating a lot, and we really have to be cognizant of that. So we just have to work with the provincial biologists to make sure that you know, we're taking the needs of the landscape into consideration. And you know, I think we have a pretty good history with everybody that we work with, so I'm not too panicked about it. But I guess that's where we're going to go in the future, I would say. It'll never be a big race, though. It'll always have small numbers.
Yeah, you can see kind of that trend in the US 200s where, you know, the races were capped at, you know, maybe 150, 200 runners early on, and now we're seeing fields of 250, 350 runners in some of the bigger 200s here. So, and some of them have similar things to contend with, you know, animal migration, sensitive ecological regions. So I can only imagine the challenges there. How much have those, you know, races in the US, the 200 plus mile races, influenced your creation of Divide, whether it was actual, you know, like tangible influence or more just inspirational influence? Like, obviously there's Candace's Big Three. It's been around for a while. Cocodona has become very popular, and we've seen another handful of, you know, three or four races in the US now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to admire Trailblazers for sure. I think I would say that more than anything, myself and my crew looked to these race directors as inspirational. You know, we have a lot of regard for people like Candace and Jamil and the others that are doing this very actively in the States and really propelling that part of ultra running forward. You know, I really have a lot of respect for them. I would say that, you know, we hear a lot of things from racers. We talk to a lot of people. We talk to volunteers that have been to these events. We talk to racers, and they ask a lot of questions of us, like, will you do this or will you do that? And that educates us as we go as well about what they expect and how we should host the event. It's really, it's important to listen more than anything. And that's the one thing that we always promise, is that we'll always do our best to recognize the needs of our competitors and to incorporate that into what we do. So yeah, I think the American 200s, and not even just American, but around the world, they've really paved a path, and you know, we all benefit from that. And you know, it's important to acknowledge what they've done to make 200s not commonplace, but inspirational and accessible. So you definitely thank them for that. It is an inspiration.
You know, with those U.S. races being inspiration, I'm just wondering how many people from the U.S. come up to do the race versus it, you know, being Canadian athletes.
I can go find out the exact numbers, but I think it's around 1/4 to 1/3. We do have a lot of interest from the U.S. I think that there are some advantages too. I mean, Canada is a little bit off the beaten track, and you know, it's almost like getting into the Wild West again. And Canada, the running scene here, if anyone hasn't been here, and I know trail running in general is very welcoming, but I think there's a certain specific flavor in the Alberta trail running scene that's extremely welcoming. And, you know, just being able to meet up with people and get help, not so much at this race, but I mean, at other races, there was a guy that flew in from California and they lost his bag. And this is for Canadian Death Race last year or year before. And he put it up on Facebook that, hey, you know, I've lost everything. I have no running gear. I have none of my food. And within a day, he was kitted out with absolutely everything, and just had a ride to the race. And you know, people really helped him out. That's really who we are as a community. And you know, there's a lot of focus on community here as well. That's what we really like to push. So I think that like I said, I know that trail running is very welcoming and inclusive everywhere we go, but I think people are kind of delighted by the local flavor here. And it's also an area that a lot of people have never had a chance to explore, which is a real shame, because you know, places like Banff and Jasper get a ton of attention in Canada. When people think about traveling in Canada and going for a vacation, like an adventure vacation, they quite often look to those big national parks. But the Castle region is just absolutely stunning. You know, there's so much to explore here. And like I said, you know, I really feel like a part of this landscape. So it's also one of those places that not many people are ever going to get a chance to see. And it's a really a special thing to be included in that.
So I think your answer just there is sort of the first half of the answer to this next question. And maybe the second half is sort of describing the course a little bit in more detail. Like, what would you say to someone who's, you know, they've run Tahoe, Bigfoot, Moab, maybe they've run Cocodona, and in lieu of just repeating those races, maybe they're looking for something else. They know, you know, Oregon 200, Divide 200 are popping up. Obviously, you just gave a lot of really cool selling points that make this race special and different. Like, so speak to the course a little bit and what a runner can expect coming to the Divide that might be different from a 200 they've already experienced.
Sure. If you take a look at the video that's on the website, you'll hear some interviews with people, and just repeating what they said, basically, there's a lot of features that you just don't see at other races. You know, it starts off with this big alpine ridge walk. I mean, you kind of start on a road, and then you get up really high, and it's the kind of place that it's really not a common feature in a race like this. It's extraordinarily remote, and from a safety standpoint, that's actually one of our big focuses. Is how do we get people out of these areas? So we did a lot of focus on the on keeping them up in the alpine, keeping them up quite high. So we use a bunch of different routes that are above tree line, and they're very exposed. In some cases, there's even a bit of scrambling and a bit of route finding. It's marked the whole way. However, you know, you do have to kind of watch your footing and watch where you're going, because it's definitely not the kind of thing where you can take your eyes off your feet. It's pretty rocky and loose in some areas. And, you know, coming from an adventure racing background where you quite often you weren't on trails at all, I don't personally have any reluctance to get people into sort of the more rugged areas. And I really think that that's the kind of racing that I like. And I like a little bit of wayfinding. I like a little bit of, I mean, not to the point where you're going to be standing with a compass or you're going to get lost, but, you know, it does challenge people to keep their eyes up, keep their heads up, and to watch what they're doing all the time in these little sections. Not for the whole race. That would be, mentally, that would be so draining. But, you know, we make sure that there are spots where it really does challenge it in that way.
So with the inaugural year, how did it go from your perspective? I'm curious. Any learnings that you're going to change for 2024?
Oh, sure. Yeah. You know, that's one thing is we learn so much every event, no matter how many times we host an event, we learn from it and we improve how we work. It went really well. You know, having done events for so long, I generally have a pretty good sense of how they'll unfold. I mean, right from the start, you know, planning the timing, I put together a spreadsheet of fastest and slowest times and kind of estimate where everyone's going to be on the course at any given time, the leaders and the tail. So that all worked out pretty well within a couple of hours of what I would have thought. A little bit slower at the start, but, you know, we learned from that for sure. Then we're making a couple of location route modifications this year that, you know, we're just getting that all finalized right now. So on, just for instance, on the stretch from checkpoint 2 to checkpoint 3, you go over these two mountains that are kind of connected by a big saddle. And when you come down, we were stationed at this really beautiful little spot on the lake, but the parking was really limited. And the parks people asked us to only take up, you know, 40% of the parking area. We negotiated that up to 75%, and then we ended up taking 110% of it. And people were just packed in everywhere. And it felt like, you know, hopefully they don't hear this, but it didn't work out badly. There were no complaints, but I mean, I felt uncomfortable with the fact that we had taken up so much of the room. We wanted to make sure there's room for other users at the lake. So we're moving to another spot that's not as nice visually, but there's a lot more parking, and it's just, you know, slight change. It's not really going to make the course change much at all, just a few hundred meters. We're changing location of another, well, the route along the High Rock Trail, which is, you know, very specific detail. The Great Divide Trail Association has been building a single track trail. We actually volunteered over several years to kind of help them with their crews and moving their crews and equipment in and out with our backcountry machines and transporting their people around. So we're happy to help them with that. And so they finally have completed the single track section. And so we're going to do some more single track in that area. We're not talking like vast stretches. We're talking, you know, we've corrected the route for 100 some meters at a time in different spots. We're moving the location of one of our main checkpoints, adding some more cutoff times just to be sure that we're keeping the race on track. I don't want to be really prescriptive about how people race, but we did realize that if we have some people that are just way, way behind in this race, that it's going to throw everything else off. So we have to really keep on top of that. We ended up actually having to hold some crew back from their other duties just to, you know, to make sure that we had eyes on some stragglers. Not towards the end of the race, more in the middle of the race. At the end of the race, surprisingly enough, the times were pretty much exactly what I thought they would be. At the tail end of the race, everyone was pretty much making the cutoffs the way I would have thought. In the middle, it was when the people were not really understanding that if you're only here, you're not going to make it to the next cutoff time. There's no way you're going to make it now. So do you really want to struggle on for the next 6 hours just to get pulled then, and keeping us all out there at the same time? So that's a very mercenary kind of a look at it, I guess. But we do have to watch out for our crew and make sure that I don't have a search and rescue guy sitting there for 6 hours waiting for somebody when there's other stuff happening. So we have to take that into consideration as well. So we're going to tighten up a little bit of that stuff. But overall, I was very pleased with how it went. You know, I think that I was surprised how much it took out of me. You know, I was pretty exhausted at the end. I can usually power through most events the whole time. There's no way I was planning on staying up for 4 days straight, but in this case, even partway through, I was like, wow, I am absolutely wiped. I can't believe how tired I am right now. And a lot of driving, that's a big part of it too. A lot of, it's a long course, and getting from place to place. It was, you know, we're going to do things like we're going to add more Starlinks to different main aid stations, just so we have better communications and that kind of stuff as well.
How much sleep do you think you got over the course of the race?
For the first day and a half, very little. But then I was just falling asleep kind of randomly after that. And a number of times the headquarters people had to come to the room that we had rented at the resort and had to wake me up because I overslept. So I feel kind of bad, but maybe not that bad because, you know, I'm just about 52 and I think, you know, I do need my sleep. My young crew can handle a bit more and I can handle a bit less.
We asked Steve Adderholt, the race director for Cocodona 250, the same question, and he had a very similar answer to you. So,
yeah.
Great. So you mentioned the search and rescue and runner safety. Like how do you approach that? I'm sure, you know, having put on other difficult races in the region is helpful, but you know, for being out there for 4 days, what does runner safety look like? What can runners expect, you know, from a self-sufficiency standpoint versus a support standpoint? Like, how does that look?
So I take that. I mean, I'm very operationally focused. You know, I have other people in place to manage like the festivities and the fun part of everything. My focus is keeping 100 people alive and on track in the bush. That's really all I worry about the whole time. And very little else matters to me at that point. So we contract, I know that in different jurisdictions, they call them different things, but we contract professional paramedics for all of our events. And we make sure that we kind of set a level of care to be, we will give, we have things like the auto defibrillators and all that around. And our paramedics are capable of giving intravenous hydration. So the hook you up to an IV, typically that's the end of your race. You know, if it's administered by one of our crew, we'll talk to them about it and say, hey, you know, do you think you can still go on after that? Because I don't want to be prescriptive, but that's the kind of level of care that we can do on site. And after that, we take people to the hospital. Any breaks, any bad bleeding that we feel we can't bandage on site and manage on site, then we'll take to the hospital. We also have contracted search and rescue. You know, we don't make these volunteer positions. Simply because as many years ago, I went through sort of a worst case scenario process for our events. And I said, look, the worst case scenario is going to be a fatality. And what happens if there's a fatality? Could, you know, and a lot of the time, I'm not trying to, you know, diminish any other events and how they operate. It's not that at all. But for me, when I looked at the, sort of the fallout, what's going to happen if there is a serious accident, I thought, can I turn to a volunteer medic and say, hey, medic, can you watch this dead body for a while? And in good conscience, I could never do that. So if I have a contractor, I can say, you're contracted to handle this. You know, you have the capability and the skills. I know you do because I've interviewed you. And I know your company. I know how you work. You have the tools and you take care of it. And then we liaise with the police and the provincial authorities, and we all have a different role to play. In a more general sense, we use what's called an incident command system. And that's a military slash sort of a disaster response method that's international. And we've modified it a little bit because we're an event, and we're a little bit different, but it's used at events as well. And essentially, everybody has a specific role that they report to. Everyone fulfills a particular job and they don't go outside of that. It's made it really easy to give good direction and make sure that everyone's focused on their part of the race, but specifically safety as well, and making sure that we're able to respond quickly. And, you know, it's also a matter of understanding where, just from a search and rescue standpoint, where can you get to them? And we have a map of every single part of the course about how you can get to it. In some cases, that's only by helicopter. and we're pretty aware of that. You know, we identify those areas and say, look, if they get hurt here, they're all carrying a satellite communicator, so that's a good thing. They can let us know. And if they're incapacitated, we'll go out looking for them. But, you know, we do talk to also the search and rescue in the region. These guys that we use are contracted outside of local search and rescue. But local search and rescue is always kept informed of what we do. So as it is the hospital. So when it comes down to it, if it goes beyond our capacity to respond, you know, we're not going to try to force our members into something dangerous. So what we do is we then enlist the help of the regional or provincial authorities. And that lets us kind of scale our response as well. So, you know, most likely if somebody's just kind of done, they're maybe twisted their ankle, they're hurt, they need a pickup, we're going to be able to get to them in most cases. If it goes beyond our capability to get to them, then we call in some reinforcements, and we don't hesitate to do that. So we have reasonable response capacity for everything, and we know where our gaps are, and that's really the important thing. That we're never at a time when we feel that we have kind of lost control. And that's kind of what I focus on through the whole race, making sure that we always know that we're in control.
Wow, that's a pretty thorough process that you've taken. So I think all of us athletes really appreciate what you all do, you know, to keep us safe.
I really hope that nobody ever has to use that. In some cases, my search and rescue crew sit there and go, wow, this has been the most boring race ever. I'm like, yeah, why am I paying you guys? But it's like insurance, right? You have to have somebody there just in case. And most of our races, we do have at least one rescue. And it depends on a lot of factors, like the area of the race, if the terrain is more difficult. The weather plays a huge factor. And just from my experience, it's not like rain and cold usually that gets them. It's the heat. Whenever we have a hot race, man, it's like carnage out there. You know, we're picking them up left, right, and center. And heat, you can dress up for the cold, but you can never dress down from the heat enough. When it gets too hot, people are just, they stop thinking properly, and they can't cool down. Their focus just turns to, wow, I feel miserable. So weather is such a big factor, and so we always have to take that into consideration as well.
Yeah, so maybe switching gears here, let's talk about something fun, prize money. So, you know, we noticed that you offer a significant prize to the first female and first male podium finishers. So just curious, what led to the decision to offer a prize pool? You know, many other similar races don't, so.
Yeah, you know, we really did want to have this as a grassroots kind of race. However, we also know that a lot of the well-known competitors out there are only going to come if there is something that's going to really draw them. Like, they need to make money as a professional athlete. And so that's kind of where it started, is we really wanted to show that we're serious about rewarding the top competitors, because this is the biggest event we've ever had. And we think it's important to, we have a very small field of people, and we feel it's important to reward that effort. And, we've never particularly catered to elite runners. And it may sound weird to say it, but in this case, we really wanted to make sure that it was something that would attract some of the bigger names for sure.
Speaking of names in the race, we had a guest on, Andrea Moore. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She's running Divide 200. I think it will be her fourth of five 200s this year, which is just, I mean, I did the Triple Crown back in 2019, and I can't imagine doing another two of those in a calendar year.
Yeah, that's both Andrea and Michael McKnight are both doing the same sort of five big 200s throughout the season, and that's wow, it's really impressive. I mean, we're so honored to have them. They you know, they sound like astounding people. And I did meet Michael very briefly last year. He was pacing a friend of his at the Divide 200. And I can't wait to see them competing out there. It's just such an inspiration to watch everybody and how they progress through the course. And they're even, you know, the top athletes having their highs and lows and what they go through. It's such a great honor to to have such spectacular and determined athletes out there.
What do you envision the future of the Divide 200 being? Like, you know, pie in the sky, where do you see this race 5-10 years down the line? And then follow up, would you ever envision another multi-day or 200-mile race for yourself or Sinister?
Yeah, you know, like I said earlier, I think that number-wise, we're going to always be capped at under 200. And I think we might try to get up to that number. But I mean, just the terrain that we're in, I don't know that we'll be able to go anything beyond that. And also with permitting and such, once you get over 200, it changes everything. So we have to be very cognizant of all that kind of stuff. And I like having it small. I think, you know, we have other big events, you know, Sinister 7, our biggest event, is still the biggest trail race in Canada. And, you know, we typically with 1,800 people signed up. So it's a pretty big deal. And I enjoy the energy of that. But in this case, I really feel it's really fun for me to be able to get to know all the athletes a little bit more personally in this race and to welcome them more personally. So I do want to keep this race small. I'll never say never to anything. You know, there's always opportunities to look at new events. Like I said, I always have more and more ideas, but yeah, I think it's something, if I get an idea and it doesn't seem to want to go away, that's when usually things start to formalize a bit more. In this case, it had been on my mind for a long time. And right now I don't have any ideas for another 200 miler, but you know, I would like to do some more events, not in just in this region. You know, we do have events in British Columbia, like kind of farther, a little bit farther west, and we have some stuff in Northern Alberta, but we're mostly concentrated down in the south of Alberta, and I'd like to get to some new areas and check them out. I think that I'm pretty happy with the way our season looks right now, and we have a lot of variety, and who knows what the future is going to bring, but you know, I think that I'd love to see some other 200 milers start in Canada as well, and to see what they do with it, and to be able to go and experience their regions. I don't know if it would be how practical it would be to have another one in the Rockies. Just knowing kind of the different areas that you could use and the constraints about permitting and such. May or may not be possible, but I'd love to see some other people start their own and be able to have some sort of friendly competition with them to really make the 200 scene a little more vibrant in Canada.
Well, great. So for anyone aspiring to participate in the Divide 200, what advice would you give them?
Well, I mean, you have to assume that they're going to have the kind of physical training that they need to be able to endure long distances and periods without sleep. I would say the same thing I say to probably to most ultra marathoners is focus on the mental aspect of it. Really get your head around tolerating the suffering and the mind tricks that you're going to, the way your mind is going to fool you into trying to stop you, basically. I mean, when you get out and you've been running for 24 plus hours, your mind is going to give you a million reasons to quit. Everything from my support group didn't have the right gel, I have a blister, you know, I think I twisted my ankle, I have a rock in my shoe that won't stop bugging me and I don't want to stop, you know, like every little thing starts to pile on and become just unbearable. And out of those million things, the million reasons why you want to quit, you have to think of the one reason why you want to keep going. And so the mental aspect is so, so important and generally overlooked. I would say, although, you know, I'm never going to say that a lot of the runners that are coming to this event are typically well-trained and they have that kind of experience. But I would say that's one area that ultramarathoners really can excel is focusing more on the mental side of it. And not just like, you know, the good visualization, but, you know, figuring out how to deal with the really low spots and getting yourself through that. Things like brushing your teeth when you're in the middle of the race. It helps a ton just to feel normal again, right? Have a beer. Like, I don't know, whatever gets your spirits up.
Awesome, Brian. We usually end these recordings with a quick five questions. So, you know, short-ish answers, whatever comes top of mind. And, You can choose to answer these questions either from your perspective as a race director or from your own personal past running events experience, your choice. Kick it off with number one. What's the highest high you've ever experienced in a race?
Probably still to this day, my first true trail run. I was invited to join a relay team. And I didn't consider myself a trail runner. I was from an orienteering background and I absolutely hit it out of the park. I had the second fastest time on that stretch of the race, only behind this kid from the national junior running team. So I felt pretty chuffed with myself, you know, that I could actually compete at that level. And it was the first time I realized, hey, I'm actually part of this community. I'm actually able to do this.
Lowest low in a race?
For me, from a race director standpoint, seeing people that are really broken and they kind of lose themselves when they drop out. It's hard to watch because you want to comfort them, but you know that this is a really common thing and you know that there's a lot of factors that led up to it. And it's not just usually one thing or another, but seeing them suffer through that, it's really heartbreaking.
What about your favorite food in a 200 or a multi-day effort?
I think that, like at our races, I think that the Divide last year, hash browns and burgers were really, really popular. We also like serve up meatballs and stuff and people really enjoyed that. But I think the being able to stop and have a burger and a pile of hash browns, like hash brown patties, was really popular.
All right. What about favorite piece of gear for a 200?
You know, outside of the normal stuff, I would say the one thing that I would recommend carrying that I would carry would be a filtering flask or a filtering straw. So you can stop and get fresh water all the time that you want. Assuming you have water sources around. That way you don't have to wait for the aid station. You don't have to worry about getting sick. Not that it's common, but it's common enough that you do have to think about it.
Yeah, I use those all the time here in the Rockies in the summer, in the Colorado Rockies. All right, final question for you. Kind of true to the name of this podcast and what we're exploring here. Do you think you personally have found your distance to empty yet?
I was pretty worn out at the end of our season last year, but I'm still here. I'm still coming back, and really comes back to why am I doing this? And I'm doing it because I love being around these people. And so, no, I'm not even close.
Awesome. Brian, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people get in touch if they have questions? Are there any information about Divide 200 registration deadlines or anything coming up that you'd like to shout out?
There's no real rush right now to get in. I mean, the race is technically full, but there will be a few dropouts, so we're letting it go on for a little bit farther, a little bit longer rather. But you know, people that are interested should sign up soon. We're going to cut off registration in June for sure, just so we can get everything squared away with planning. But if they need to know more, it's divide200.ca. And, we'd be happy to see them out there. It's again, it's a real special place for me. So I really would love to be able to show more people what we have to offer here in the Southern Canadian Rockies.
Awesome. Go check out the Divide 200. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, I'll be honest, I didn't particularly have the Divide 200 high on my list. I feel like I just have so many races and stuff like jumbled around in my brain that I like want to do. But after talking to Brian, I definitely am kind of jonesing to put it on the list and get up there and see what that area is all about and try a new 200.
Yeah, I agree. I've seen a bit of what that area might be like from the Montana side. So I know how beautiful it can be. And yeah, it's on my list as well. And also another takeaway I had from the discussion was just how focused he is on safety for the race. That kind of blew me away. Just his answers to the questions about everything he does to keep us safe out there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, all the races seem to have a pretty good system in place, but theirs definitely seemed like above and beyond over the top, which is like really cool for such a remote area and definitely peace of mind for anyone who's out there risking their lives for a belt buckle.
So should we get into some categories?
Let's do it. Do you want to kick us off with performance of the week this week?
Yep, I'll start with performance of the week. So this past weekend, we had the Black Canyon races. So the performance of the week goes to Andrea Moore. She completed the 100-mile challenge, which included 100K on day one and then a 60K on day two. And she was one of only two females to finish that challenge. So kudos to her. And also, she is doing the Divide 200 this year as one of her five races. So pretty amazing accomplishment.
Yeah, that's awesome. We had Andrea on. If you haven't listened to Andrea's episode, go back and check it out. She's doing five 200 milers in 2024. And this was just a training weekend for her. So pretty epic.
All right. So should we try some candy?
Yeah, let's try some candy. I've been looking forward to this particular snack since we ordered these snacks to review from Galactic Snacks, which is like a exotic different country candy and snacks company. So fittingly, today we have one of our favorite brands of candy, and it is from Canada, which is where the Divide 200 is. So this is a Sour Cherry Blaster Sour Patch Kids. And I don't know about you, Peter, but it's a Sour Patch candy product, and it was like, it's the best thing I've had from this order yet. It was just so good.
I agree. Yeah, I think I like it even better than typical Sour Patch Kids. I think at Cocodona, I ate like 3 pounds of Sour Patch Kids or something. So this is one of my go-tos, and I wish we had these Sour Cherry Blasters. To me, it tasted like a cherry icy. This cherry flavor really came in strong. And the sour was maybe just a notch lower than typical. So really easy to eat. If you're doing the Divide, definitely pick these up.
Yeah, we'll have to get Francis to smuggle some in for us. I'm surprised he's never mentioned them before.
That sounds right. He didn't wake me up in Moab's.
That's true. He's not a very good friend, Francis. do you want to hit me with a course corner today, Peter?
Yeah, let's do it. So how about Bigfoot? We haven't done a Bigfoot section yet. So talk to me about the Klickitat to Twin Sister section.
Oh, yeah. So Bigfoot's one of my favorite 200s. I've done it three times. This section from Klickitat to Twin Sisters, I think it's like, it's kind of infamous. And, you know, part of it is because it's really difficult, but I think also of like where its placement is in the race. It's sort of the crux for a lot of people because of when they hit it, both like time of day and also like just overall like distance and fatigue into the race. It's a really challenging section. It doesn't have any like singular huge climbs or anything, but it is about 5,000 feet of gain in 19 or so miles. And it's made up of a lot of like short punchy climbs. There are quite a few sections where you could like fall and hurt yourself too. There's quite a few drop-off-y sections that you have to be careful on, which it's hard when you're that deep into the race. What else do I remember from this section? Mosquitoes. If it's a mosquito year, this is where they're going to be. It's almost impossible to sleep when mosquitoes are eating you alive and surrounding you. And yeah, it's just, it's the section from hell on this course for sure. You know, when you get to Twin Sisters, there's an out and back, about a 3 mile out and back to Twin Sisters. That section, the out and back part, is not too bad. And from there, you really do feel like you're in the home stretch. So it's kind of like the final big hurdle of the course, in my opinion. I've also, three for three, mostly hitting this section in the dark. I have heard it is absolutely beautiful. And maybe it's a little less miserable if you're getting to take advantage of some of that beauty.
Awesome. Yeah. Bigfoot's on my list as well. I haven't done it yet. I've also heard people buy bug nets. I guess maybe it's for that section.
You do have a finisher print from Bigfoot, don't you?
I do. They mixed up. So I could tell people I did it, but I have not done it.
You should hang it behind you. We'll just tell people you did Bigfoot. It's fun.
Eventually.
All right. It's time for my favorite part. Let's get deep.
Let's get deep.
Let's Get Deep is a card game for couples that Peter and I play on the podcast. So there's three categories: icebreaker, deep, and deeper. I'll kick it off today with Peter's icebreaker. Peter, this is a pretty simple one. I think I know the answer, but who knows? Maybe you'll surprise me. Do you believe in ghosts? Why or why not?
I think since I have a kind of scientific mind and I went to school for engineering, I'm going to say no on that one. I don't know. I have trouble believing in supernatural things.
Yeah, fair enough.
All right, your icebreaker. This should be a fun one. What's your go-to snack at the movies?
Oh, so I always get popcorn with butter, and I always get a sweet snack as well. So it's candy and popcorn. The popcorn with butter is a staple, and the candy is usually like a sour candy variety, like sour straws, sour patch kids, sour something. Occasionally, I'll do like Raisinets or Butterfinger or Snow Caps, but I mean, if you couldn't tell with the quick answers, it's candy, and whatever it is going to suffice. All right, deep for you. I feel like we could change the word do in this question to don't, but I'll read it as is. What childish thing do you still enjoy today? Why?
I'll go with video games. I still love video games. I've played through all the Zeldas that have come out. My kids have a Switch, but I think I really got it for me. As they're getting older, I think I need to buy more Switches. So,
I was gonna guess Legos too.
oh yeah, there's Lego also. Yeah, a lot of things. All right, deep for you. What hobby would you pick up if time and money weren't an issue?
I saw that card. I almost picked that for you today. We haven't had a duplicate yet. Man, I feel like if time and money were an issue, I'd like to do more like wildlife stuff, like go on like safari trips and like wildlife tours in like, South America, Africa, and really see some of the like big carnivores, big game animals out there. I'm a huge fan of the Tooth and Claw podcast and just kind of like obsessed with wildlife in general. So just to go appreciate some of that, I'd love to see like polar bears up in like the Arctic and Svalbard and just witness that stuff before it's gone.
Well, ne next time you're in San Diego, we'll do the wild animal park.
Cool. Sounds good. All right, deeper for you. This is a really deeper one. This is like a like deep deep. What do you like best about your life, and what do you like least about your life?
I guess what do I like best is that for the most part, I think I'm able to do all the things I want to do. So have a good job. And have been able to, do all these races and have a family, go camping, and that's pretty much what I enjoy doing. I guess what I like least about my life, I don't know, pretty deep, but having to deal with a kid with health issues, I think that's something not fun. I would not wish that on anyone else to have to go through that.
Yeah, that's fair. And it's the month, it's February is the national month of his health issue, isn't it?
Yeah. February is National Heart Month. Yeah, so my kid was born with congenital heart defects.
Yeah. Well, I think he's gonna be president one day though. He's a good kid.
Hopefully.
If he wants to be.
I don't think he wants to be. Then deeper for you, if you could have a video of any moment in your life, which would you pick and why?
Oh man, that's a really cool one. Well, maybe, just maybe it's because it's fresh and I just answered in a similar way for the last one. But Melanie and I, on our honeymoon back in 2015, we got charged at by a moose. We were the only ones on the trail. It was during the rut. It caught us off guard. We didn't see it before it saw us. And it was like probably the scariest moment of our lives. And be really cool to have I would love to see to watch that, right? To like see how that played out and if it's as scary and crazy as I remember, because it was wild. And there was no one around. We were in Grand Teton National Park and it came around a corner like full speed. That was terrifying. So I'll go with that.
That sounds good. I think we need to do a whole episode on animal encounters.
I think I've mentioned it before. I like my dream is to get like Tooth and Claw to like come on the podcast and talk about like trail, because they talk about trail running a lot in their episodes. If you haven't checked out Tooth and Claw podcast, check it out. I think they'd be down to like talk running safety and wildlife.
We just need some more subscribers.
Yeah. Please give us a follow, give us a subscribe, leave us a review, tell us what you want to hear. Call out Tooth and Claw podcast. Yeah, but there's a lot of that wildlife is up on the Divide course too. I think they have grizzlies, rare, but I think they have grizzlies up there.
Yeah, I think bear spray is in the mandatory gear, I think.
Yeah, so they must have grizzlies if that's the case. They definitely have moose and mountain lions and all that stuff. So, Yeah, well, thanks for listening. Like Peter said, give us that, smash that like and subscribe button. Leave us some reviews, and thanks for listening. Tune in next week.